นะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะนะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะนะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะพุทธังธัมมังสังฆังขนุตตรังอุปัชฌายังนมัสสามิ
One of the concepts which I believe is missing, or at least is not at all clear or coherent in the Western world, at least as far as I'm aware, is that of the perfected human being, or the idea that of perfection in this imperfect life, or an idea of completeness in an incomplete world. And what is the highest, what is the best that can be hoped for from life in this world? Now that to begin with, that already may be challenged, to say, well, who decides on the criteria? Who decides that one way of life, one way of looking at the world, one way of acting, of thinking, is in any way better than any other way? Isn't that just a matter of opinion? In Buddhism, in Theravada Buddhism in particular, we insist upon the humanity of the Buddha, the historical Buddha. In the Mahayana tradition, the Buddha is often conceived in a much more metaphysical way. In Theravada, we look to the Buddha as a human being, a very special human being, undoubtedly, but one who, through his own efforts, proved exactly what human beings are capable of. So he was enlightened, if you like, as a representative of the human race. And his disciples, both men and women, both monastics and householders, have over the past 2,500 years proved through their own efforts that his enlightenment was not just a fluke, not just a one-off or something that was particular to him, but something which is truly accessible to all human beings. And so the teachings in Theravada Buddhist tradition are concerned primarily with this challenge to realize the full potential of our human birth, following in the footsteps of the Buddha and of his great disciples. So, having the goal of Nibbana or enlightenment, we have a compass, as it were. We have, based upon a belief in the possibility of actualizing, of realizing Nibbana, then on that ground we have a criteria for deciding what is good, what is bad, what is right, what is wrong, what is better, what is best. All those actions of body, speech and mind which lead away from the highest goal are considered bad. All those actions of body, speech and mind which lead towards the goal are good. So good and bad, right and wrong, these terms have meanings within the Buddhist tradition in relation to this path towards enlightenment. So enlightenment is conceived not as like a special state or as a particular place, but it can be understood most easily in psychological terms as a complete absence of all forms of greed, aversion and delusion. So that's the what they call the via negativa, the negative formulation. The positive formulation is that a perfection, a completeness of wisdom and compassion. There is a third quality usually added to that, although was not taught by the Buddha himself, and that is a purity, meaning a complete freedom, inner freedom from all defilement. So the path is one in which we seek to reduce and overcome the greed and hatred and delusion and all their offspring and children and grandchildren, and to find ways of promoting and nurturing all those qualities that manifest primarily in wisdom, and compassion, and goodness, and freedom. So this is a path which we can characterize as being organic or holistic, in the sense that the different aspects and the different stages are interconnected. Traditionally, we speak of a threefold education or a threefold training. The first stage of which is devoted to a training of conduct, the second, training of the emotions, and the third, the training of wisdom. Now, in that three-step or threefold training, the first of conduct is one in which the training of emotion and the training of wisdom is present in a supportive role. In the training of emotion, the training in conduct and wisdom is present also in the background in a supporting role. And the training of wisdom, similarly, must be accompanied by the training in conduct and of emotion in the background. So it's not that there's step one, step two, step three, but in each stage all three aspects are present, but that one takes precedent or is manifest. So, for instance, in the case of the training of conduct, then it's important to recognize that the teachings in the area which we would loosely call morality, although we can immediately see a great deal of overlap with the moral codes of other religious systems, there is something unique to be observed here, and that is that there is no reward and punishment involved. There are no commandments, but that the Buddhist takes on voluntarily the training of conduct. And if there isn't a sense of voluntary commitment, then even though a person might refrain from killing and stealing and so on, he wouldn't be considered to be, or she wouldn't be considered to be, actually actively committed to this education process. Because if we're merely avoiding certain kinds of actions out of fear of the reactions of others, humiliation, criticism, or perhaps even being punished and put into jail, then it would not have the connection with the training in of emotion and the training of wisdom which is necessary for it to be a Buddhist morality or a Buddhist sila. So in the ceremony in which lay Buddhists take the five precepts, the ceremony begins with the request for the precepts. And that is significant. There has to be the sense of taking on these precepts as tools to educate our conduct and as objects of mindfulness in daily life. It's very difficult, isn't it, to maintain any kind of stream of awareness in a very confused and confusing environment where there are constantly varied calls upon our attention. And times when we have to be active, other times we need to be passive, and times we need to talk, and times we need to listen. So many different things going on. And most so-called meditation techniques are not really sustainable in that kind of environment. But what we can be aware of in our daily life and is a basic grounding in the present moment are the precepts that we take on as trainings of conduct to refrain from hurting and harming and from stealing and taking what's not given and so on. And these precepts can be refined upon. We can take those as the basic objects of awareness, but we may add on trainings for ourselves in addition to that. For instance, in the case of the third precept of refraining from adultery, you might make, a training rule for yourself of not to speak on the telephone or have email conversations with members of the other sex more than a certain number of minutes or more than a certain number of times a month or something. You can make particular private kinds of standards for yourself, which are a very good means of bringing yourself back to the present moment and reminding yourself of your responsibilities and so on. So the ability to keep these precepts well is dependent upon ability to recognize and to keep abreast of the intentions forming in your mind, because sila in the Buddhist sense is essentially a matter of intention. And so we can see that there has to be this inner training to complement the outer training. You have to be mindful, in other words. So the wisdom faculty involved here is seeing the value of the precepts, each precept, each training rule that you take upon yourself voluntarily. You really see the suffering, the difficulties, the confusion that will arise from not keeping the precept, and the value and the benefit of keeping it. And this is one of the basic wisdom techniques. The very first initial level of wisdom development is this thinking in terms of pros and cons, as we say in English, seeing the benefits and the drawbacks, and training oneself to do that in a very systematic way in your daily life, particularly in terms of the standards that I mentioned a moment ago, those things which free the mind, which uplift the mind, and those things which drag the mind downwards, seeing, well, this particular activity, this particular way of speaking, does it make the mind bright and clear, or does it make the mind feel very cloudy and soiled after I've acted in this way and spoken this way? Do I feel guilt and remorse, or do I feel joy and contentment? So bringing those standards to bear in a kind of a pros and cons analysis of action is part of the training in sila. And the benefits that we can see very clearly are both internal and external. Externally, we can see that any family, community, society will thrive in the presence of trust, and will wither and will have serious difficulties whenever that trust is lost. And the trust is created and sustained when the members of a family or community have shared standards of conduct. So we can't, of course, forbid ourselves from having angry thoughts, covetous thoughts, lustful thoughts, and so on. But we can recognize them as thoughts and not feel compelled to act upon them. We can have a certain standard. Well, that's fair enough. That's a thought that's arisen according to causes and conditions. No need to feel terrible about it. But our freedom lies in that we have standard of conduct which we will uphold. So in Buddha Dhamma, we make it very clear that unwholesome and negative thoughts and emotions are not things that we can take responsibility for and that we should feel bad about, but that we should seek to heal or to deal with. We realize that they've arisen because of ways that we've acted, ways that we've thought in the past. These are ingrained habits, but they're not inherent in our minds and our consciousness. They're things that have accumulated until they've become automatic in our minds, but through supporting wholesome dhammas of kindness and wisdom and mindfulness and so on, then they can be gradually undermined. And then those thoughts and mental states that pop up into the mind spontaneously change in nature and become more and more wholesome and good and kind. So there's nothing fixed in the mind at all. There are merely energies and things which have been being promoted and had been encouraged, sometimes over many lifetimes. Those, in that case, takes quite a while to deal with these things and to be very patient. So rather than looking at precepts as commandments, we're looking at them as ways of developing mindfulness, groundedness in daily life, giving us certain standards that we can come back to and to align our behavior, practically speaking, with our ideals. And they are means by which we can create practically the kind of families and the kind of communities that everybody wants to live in, where we feel a sense of trust, kindness, warmth, safety, security. So the training in precepts is considered absolutely essential to the higher or the more subtle levels of training, because without that foundation in sila, we tend to lack the self-confidence, we tend to lack the good feeling towards ourselves, the self-esteem, self-respect, that sense of being a good friend to yourself, which is essential when you are starting to enter into areas of experience which are strange or unusual or unprecedented. And that kind of emotional stability that comes from leading a blameless life is absolutely essential. So there are a lot of teachings which speak of the person on the path, or the person who is steadfast on the path, the person who is the good man or the good woman. They call the Satpurusa. And there's one particular group of dhammas or virtues of the good person, which I think are quite useful to learn about and to memorize, again, as a kind of a checkpoints for your own practice. And they are essentially things that you know, or a wise person will know, or will have some acquaintance with and have some grounding in. And the first two are a pair, and one is knowing the causes, the conditions of things, and one is knowing the results or the goal of things. So I think generally speaking, we can see in many people tend to have an imbalance here. Some people very inspired with ideals and slogans and find some kind of exasperation and with the nitty-bitty, the details, the actual work needed to actualize those ideals. The thing like just want the sort of broad strokes of sort of the big picture in this, and finding that emphasis on methods, methodology, on you know, what we're doing right now, step by step, to be a bit depressing and a bit kind of just a hard drudge. Whereas the moment you think of sort of great spiritual ideas and spiritual enlightenment, well, it's just full of energy. And so the problem being that one's just feeding off some idea rather than doing the work which will lead to the idea, and perhaps lacking the understanding of what exactly are the causal conditions for realizing that. So the wise person is one who is very meticulous in terms of understanding and actualizing the causes and conditions for success in any particular endeavor. The other extreme, of course, is when people just get too caught up in the details of things, very meticulous, very careful, so on, but forget why they're doing it in the first place. And so this is why the second virtue of the wise person is that they always keep the goal in mind. And so what's the big picture here? What are we doing this for in the first place? You know, if you're sometimes in relationships where you can get into these kind of ongoing arguments where everything just shrinks down to, you know, having a victory in this particular argument, or not be, or having the last word, or being the one who is acknowledged to be right, and perhaps giving that so much importance that being willing to do long-term damage to a relationship, forgetting the whole point of living together in the first place. So the wise person is one who gives equal value, appropriate value to causes, techniques, methods, and is constantly looking to improve. This is a factor which has a particular quality or name in Pali, or what we monks are, which means constantly checking and looking to for faults in the way that you do things, not taking things for granted and say, well, I've done it like this, this is the way I do it, it's my style, it's right, it's good enough, but being humble enough, willing enough to look again and to make changes and to learn from mistakes, but at the same time keeping in mind the overall goal. Why? What is the reason? What is the purpose? Why am I doing this? For what purpose? This is very important reflection in our lives, and one which has significance for time management. Of course, you know, there's that kind of nice. This isn't a Buddhist thing, but I think it's within the boundaries of like that. What is it? I'm thinking in Thai now. Urgent and necessary. Necessary, not urgent. Urgent, not necessary. Not necessary, not urgent. So, you know, being able to do what's both necessary and urgent first, and what's not necessary and not urgent last, or not at all. The second and the third one, I think, are probably the most interesting. Things which are urgent and not necessary, and necessary and not urgent, because I think we tend to put the urgent but not necessary before necessary and not urgent. It's one of the reasons why so few people keep up their meditation practice on a regular basis. So these two points of the method, the methodology, the practice, and the results, both on the day-to-day level and on a sort of a larger long-term level. Next one is knowing yourself, and this can seem a little strange given the well-known Buddhist emphasis on teaching of not-self, but the word self is used by the Buddha in the conventional level, meaning an awareness of your strong points and weak points, and not being not fooling yourself or turning a blind eye to your weaknesses. You know, it's very very easy to waste a lot of time and to become very frustrated, disappointed, putting effort into things which are really not suited to at all. And and constantly overlooking and justifying weak points and faults, and trying to create situations and conditions where we don't have to face up to those things. That's why in monastic life, in the forest monasteries, monks have to spend like at least 5 years, like sort of apprenticeship, living in communities before they have the opportunity to go off on retreat by themselves. Because there's so many things that you, it's difficult to learn in solitude that you can learn more easily in community. Similarly, there are a lot of things that you can learn in solitude that you can't learn so easily in community. But in community, you're constantly being confronted with people who have a different idea of who you are than you have. And some of these people are quite intelligent, usually in monastic communities, and quite sensitive and perceptive. So it's not easy to dismiss them in the same way. And it's a reason why young monks, you know, start to pine for solitude often. You know, it's difficult for monks because you have all these teachings about the joys of solitude, and it's sort of the ideal life of a monk. So something I teach my own students and monks in the monastery is that if you quarrel with other monks, don't think that you go off and live in solitude, it'll be any better, because if you quarrel with other monks, you live by yourself, you'll quarrel with yourself. It's only if you can live at peace with other monks that you have necessary maturity to live alone. So there are lots of spiritual teachings which can be used to justify ourselves and to lie to ourselves, basically. And living in community is sometimes compared with living like a pebble on the seashore with a lot of other pebbles. The sea comes in, the sea comes out, the pebbles rub against each other, and over the course of time they become very smooth. Whereas rocks or pebbles on a mountaintop never get any kind of friction, and so they remain kind of ugly and jagged for a long time. So the living with others and living in ways where people sort of rub you up the wrong way is not a bad thing in itself. If we're taking on this process of interest and wanting to understand oneself and to see the areas in which we attach and cling to things and the lies that we tell ourselves, then living with others, with good friends and people who have similar spiritual ideals and people who we can trust is a great benefit. So knowing ourselves, knowing where we need to work, and being able to apply effort there in a very humble way. We can't in spiritual life take calendars very seriously. And people say, well, I've been doing this for weeks now, or months now, or even years now, and it's, I don't see, you know, any movement, anything happening. Well, that's not necessarily true anyway, but even if it were, if we take a different time scale and think, well, perhaps you've been accumulating an unwholesome habit for, let's say, 1,000 lifetimes, you know, what's 10 years? You know, it depends on the time scale that you take. It's more a matter of saying, is something worth doing? And then saying, well, I'll just keep at it until I'm successful. I don't know if some of you may have read a book called Outliers by Malcolm Gladwell. It's one of my favorite writers, and he has a chapter in this book on the reasons why Asian kids tend to be better at maths than American kids or European kids. And one or two of the experiments that have been done, they gave children, one Japanese or Japanese children, American children, maths problems which they knew were too difficult for them, and to see what happened. And the Japanese children tended to keep on at the trying to work out the problem much longer, significantly longer, than the American children. Then the second section, they gave them two further questions, one very similar to the first one, which they couldn't answer, and another one of a different type. Nearly all of the American children switched to the second kind of question, concluding, well, the first kind of question is too difficult, and try a second time question, whereas almost all the Japanese kids went for the question which was similar to the first one, which they couldn't answer, because, well, maybe that will give me an insight in how to work out this particular kind of problem. So a number of different kinds of tests came up with the overall conclusion that essentially it's the willingness to keep at something, to stick at something, not to give up, to be patient, which is the primary conditioning factor for success in this and in many other endeavors, almost all endeavors. So these are kind of very basic, everyday, mundane kinds of qualities that perhaps we don't give so much importance as we might. It's being willing to keep at something and not keep looking at the clock or not looking at the calendar, and just then when you've decided something, it's worth doing no matter how long it takes. Now, well, it takes as long as it takes, and we have no idea of what's happened in previous lives and what baggage we're bringing into this life. So we work with what we've got. The next quality is knowing the right amount. This phrase usually translated into English is moderation, but it's in Pali or in Thai it's Brahman, which is more a sense of just the right amount, the optimum, knowing what's the optimum amount. And this teaching particularly is applied to our relationship to the material world, to possessions, to money, and so on and so forth. So rather than this idea of the more the better, the sense that it's never enough, it's saying, well, what's the right amount? What is the optimum amount? And again, we can see that the sense of you can only really reflect on and determine the optimum amount if you have this idea of the best, or the goal that you're moving towards or you aspire to. So in the Buddhist idiom, we'll say, okay, we're trying to move towards a sense of inner freedom, self-reliance, wisdom, compassion, kindness, inner peace, and so on. These are the goals that we're moving towards. So we say, well, how much money do we need? How much work do I need to do? What kind of work do I need to do? How many possessions do I need to do? Which is most conducive to the goals that I aspire to, or at the very least, which is least obstructive to them. Certainly, often in family life, for sure, we have to make a number of compromises with the people around us who don't have the same goals and ideals. But if we don't have that sense that this is as conducive as possible, then at least having the sense that is as least obstructive as possible to the development of these spiritual goals that we aspire to. And again, using our wisdom faculty to reflect upon the nature of sensual desires, and not taking a kind of a Puritan or moralistic attitude to everyday enjoyments, but saying, well, what really do we get from them? You know, is it really as satisfying as we would like to think? One of the similes given by the Buddha, a very similar one, is it's like you've got an itch. He's saying you've got an itch. In fact, he gives a very graphic example of someone with leprosy, but let's just take it on the level of someone with an itch. You know, and you scratch an itch, and it's really nice. You know, you scratch an itch, that feels good, no doubt about it. But the problem is that not very long afterwards, the itch comes back, and often the itch is worse than it was before because of the scratch. So you have scratching gives pleasure, but it is a cause for an intensification of the basic problem. And the Buddha is saying this is a model for the kind of sensual pleasures that we chase after in daily life, that we have a sense of lack, a sense of incompleteness, of loneliness, of tension, of something not quite right, which propels us towards various pleasures, which do temporarily take away that feeling or take away that itch, but in the long term, in fact, make it even worse. And the Buddha is also pointing towards the law of diminishing returns, and that one, a certain level, certain amount of stimulation doesn't give the same amount of pleasure consistently. After a while, the amount of pleasure decreases through familiarity, through boredom or whatever. So you have to increase the stimulation, increase its intensity or its variety. And so you're on this constant kind of restless quest for some kind of cessation of the sense of lack, which is ultimately frustrating. So that's not, you know, an object of faith in Buddhists, but the Buddha's asking us to look at our experience of sensual pleasure and seeing the whole picture, and actually how wise, how successful is this as a means of dealing with our suffering in life. So in for lay Buddhists, the Buddha gives the five precepts. Said, well, okay, you know, it's perfectly all right to enjoy the pleasures of the senses if they're not leading to pain and suffering and inflicting pain and suffering on other people. So you have that those kind of boundaries there. So it's perfectly all right to go to the movies and listen to music and all these kinds of things, but the Buddha would recommend to have at least one day a month or 2 days a month, perhaps 4 days a month on the one prat day, where you refrain from those things just as a quiet day and a check, and to see to what extent you're getting attached to those things and what it's like to live without them just for a while. So there's that constant sense of interest and looking at our experience and using precepts, for instance, as a way of seeing that. Once you have that sense of podi, of just the right amount, there is a sense of real balance and coolness in life. So the next one is knowing time and place. This is a recurrent theme in the training, and which is very much dependent on the development of mindfulness and that kind of sensitivity to situations and sensitivity to the ripeness of situations. And when we are very angry or anxious about something, and sometimes we're very self-righteous about something, and something really does need to be said, but because we don't have that sense of time and place, we speak about it in prematurely, when the other person is not ready, not in a right frame of mind to be able to listen to what we're saying, or we ourselves are just so caught up in our emotion that we end up speaking far more strongly than we intended to, and find ourselves speaking hurtfully or offending the other person, and so on and so forth. So it's not that perhaps a conversation shouldn't take place, But that because we lack that sense of time and place and being able to patiently wait until the conditions are the best possible way they could be for the for this particular conversation to take place, that we find great frustration. A lot of things that need to be done, we find we don't have enough time because we're too busy doing other things. And so going back to this whole time management again. But mindfulness is that quality of being present, and being present not just to your own body and mind, but to the whole context in which you are living and what's going on around you. And the last two of these qualities are concerned with this also, and they're social qualities. That's knowing the individual and knowing the group or the community or the society. Now, one of the values of a regular meditation practice is that you are, as it were, coming face to face with the human condition. You're putting the human condition under a microscope, as it were, the human condition as it manifests in your own body and mind. So when you try to be mindful and to steady the mind, clarify the mind, then it's like trying to train a wild animal, and it reacts, and the mind goes crazy, and it falls into habitual modes of escape. And we can see how the mind tries to escape into pleasant fantasies, imagination, memories, or it gets caught up in aversion and anger, or depression, boredom, laziness, or mental agitation, or doubts. And all these mental states arise and become very clearly manifest as reactions to this effort to dwell awake and mindful in the present moment. So if we don't take it all very personally, but we see these as mental states, then even while our meditation practice is not particularly strong, we're deriving a great deal of understanding of the way that negative mental states work, what they feed on, what makes them stronger, what makes them weaker, how they arise, how they pass away. So if you see within yourself this your own sense of greed and lust and covetousness and aversion and so on as a mental state which is arising and trying to pull the mind away from the present moment, then you are developing an understanding of that human quality which is manifest in everyone else. So the clearer insights you have into different mental states which manifest in your own mind, then the more understanding you have of the people around you, the way that you lie to yourself is the way that other people lie to themselves. When you see how your mind can just be swept away by some negative emotion just out of the blue, and how strong and powerful it can be, and how difficult it is to deal with, then ideally, when you see that in somebody else, there is an enhanced empathy and understanding and forgiveness. Oh, that's exactly what happens to me. You know, that person's just completely lost it because of that particular event or something. You know, that happens to me when that happens. And so the more you see, the more you look at the way your own mind works, the more you understand how other people's mind works. And this is one of the benefits of meditation practice, which which becomes apparent very quickly, even though, as I say, you may not feel yet that you've derived any great benefit from meditation, sense of enhanced inner peace and wisdom and so on. But there is this growing insight into the human condition through having to deal with the nitty-gritty of your own human condition that manifests when you try to meditate. The last of these qualities is understanding of communities, how communities work, and being able to function within families and communities in the best possible way. And so quite a qualities here that are needed. One was saying is sila and restraint of body and speech and that aspect of the training, but also being able to adapt and compromise and not to attach too strongly to views and opinions and beliefs in particular. So the teaching of non-attachment is a very central one in the Buddhist tradition. And my teacher, he would say very simply, if you attach to something a lot, you suffer a lot. You attach to something a little, you suffer a little. You don't attach, then you don't suffer. And what attachment means in this sense is attaching to something as me or mine, or in other terms, identifying with something. So if you have a particular idea or a particular opinion and you identify with it, then you get into an argument, and then suddenly where's all this emotion coming? Actually quite a minor point of procedure or way of doing things, and suddenly there's all this kind of emotion coming up, because it's not so much the issue itself. It's your relationship to the issue, and the fact that you know your sense of self, your standing in the community, your dignity, your respect and your image and so on has all been projected onto this idea. So you have to protect this idea and fight for this idea come what may. And so you can find yourself, I'm sure I found myself in a position where you're protecting and speaking up quite strongly for a position you no longer hold. You've already been convinced that you've got it wrong, but you just can't somehow come around to admitting that, in the course of an argument. So that sense of attaching to particular thoughts, ideas, being willing to compromise, being willing to let go of the way you like to do things in certain areas, but in a sense also knowing when not to compromise. If you take fitting in as your goal, then that's dangerous also. If you're with people who have very different ideas of what life's about, or different ideas of the right ways to behave, and you can just lose your whole anchor and sense of groundedness if you simply try to take the path of least resistance. You want to be popular, you want to be loved by everyone and liked by everyone. So this is why those precepts which I was speaking about at the beginning are so important. You say, well, yes, I'm willing to compromise in other areas in terms of what I like personally, or what I think is enjoyable, not enjoyable, but not going to break any precepts just to make other people happy. So that there has to be that sense of integrity also. Learning from communities and the values of communities and what you can give to communities. We can all give something, and the act of giving is something which brings immediate and lasting joy to life. In Buddhism, we talk about making merit, and often in terms of giving. And this Buddhist teaching says that if you give without any desire for anything in return, you make a lot more merit than if you give with hope of something in return. So, you know, what does that mean? The whole idea of merit is maybe a kind of difficult one to grasp sometimes. But let's take an example. If you recall some occasion in the past in which you gave something, it might have been money, it might have been a material object, it might have been time, it might have been anything, which you gave without any desire for anything in return at all. Now, I think you'll notice that even if that event took place 5 years ago, or 10 years ago, or 20 years ago even, or 30 years ago even, or however, the moment you think about it, it feels really good. You just feel really warm and bright and happy. Whereas, if there was some occasion in the past where you gave some support, you gave some money, gave with some desire for some material advantage, or perhaps just to be admired, or to be liked, or to be well known, or whatever, after some time has passed, you can think of that, remember it, and you just feel kind of nothing. So. So what the Buddha is saying here is that when we give without any desire for anything in return, we create like a treasure in our hearts, and one which is accessible to us throughout our lives, even in times when we're in desperate straits or we're in great physical pain. Just the recollection of the good actions that we have performed in the past are an immediate kind of salve or balm on the mind, and it's something that you carry around with you everywhere, and that's what merit means. Whereas when you do things quite admirable things, but there is some desire for something, you may well receive that short-term benefit, that worldly benefit, but in terms of some kind of spiritual resource, spiritual power, something that you can turn your mind towards at any time and feel sustained, then that's not going to happen. So living with others gives us, in communities, gives us many opportunities to give in this way, creating happiness around us, but also creating long-term inner benefits and sense of brightness and uplift. And the more we let go of our attachment to our own likes and dislikes and what we want, what we like, what we don't like, then that sense of community, inner community, of being all in this together, we're all in the same boat, we're all, as they say in Buddhist idiom, companions in birth, old age, sickness and death, becomes very clear, and we see that kind of selfish, everyone out for themselves kind of idea is in fact quite an unintelligent idea. So just to illustrate this, I've got a little story I'd like to tell you. So I was telling people this morning, I'll tell you again, and it's about a farm, and in this farm they like to eat cheese. And there's a little mouse who likes to eat cheese as well. So the mouse likes to creep into the house and eat some of the cheese. I mean, only just a very small amount. But the farmer doesn't like it. The farmer's wife doesn't like it. So they put down a trap. And the mouse sees the trap and is very frightened, runs out of the house and calls a meeting with his friends. And his friends, there's a cow and a pig and a chicken. And he said, "Friends, we're in trouble. The farmer's put down a mouse trap. You know, if I go in there at night time and they move it around, you know, I could be killed. I know I really need my friends to help me out here and speak to the farmer and ask him to take this thing away. I mean, I just take a very small amount of cheese. It's not only leftovers anyway." And the cow said, Ah, that's your problem. I don't have enough time for that. You know, I'm out in the field all day. Do you know how much grass I have to eat in order to fill my stomach? You know, it's just to, I don't have time for that, your petty problems. And the pig says, I just don't get on with the farmer. You know, we just don't see eye to eye. We're always, you know, I speak to him, he doesn't listen, and it's a big waste of time. Sorry. Then the chicken says, "Oh, I'm not." And the chicken doesn't like the mouse, and he just finds some kind of excuse. He's not going to help. None of them want to help. Poor old mouse, isolated. None of his friends are going to help him. That night, a snake goes up into the house, gets its tail caught in the mouse trap, and doesn't die. It's a lot of pain. And the farmer's wife comes to the kitchen in the morning, and the angry, frightened snake bites the housewife. And so she's in a lot of pain. And a doctor comes and puts some kind of salve on it. It doesn't look good. So she's very ill and very weak. And so, of course, what do you give a very sick, weak person to eat? Chicken soup. So the farmer goes out and wrings the chicken's neck, makes chicken soup for the woman. She's still not getting better, and of course those days the communication's not very well, they don't have very good, they don't have cars and things. You can't just go in the morning, come back in the evening. So there's a steady stream of people coming to visit, spending overnight, and they're running out of food. So what can he do? So farmer kills a pig to make some pork chops and feed all his guests. Poor lady, she still doesn't get better, and then she dies. And they have a funeral. So many people come for this funeral. How are you going to feed them all? Just have to kill the cow and feed all the guests at the funeral. So, sad story. The chicken and the pig and the cow all die because they wouldn't help their poor friend, the mouse, to ask the farmer to take the mouse trap out of the house. So, this is one of these old stories for children that I love, and I think good for adults as well. And, it reminds me, I don't know if anyone, and I can't remember this verbatim, but there's a poem, I think, written by a Christian, a German pastor called Bonhoeffer in the Second World War. And he talks about the Nazis. You know, first they came for the brown shirts, and we thought, you know, so it serves them right, nothing to do with us. And they came for the communists, and we thought, well, that's nothing to do with us. Then they came for the gays and the gypsies, nothing to do with us. And they came for the Jews, and nothing came for us. And now they come for the Christian pastors, and it's too late. So this idea, you know, that we're saying, well, just look after me and mine, and just let everyone else look after themselves. Is not only wrong, but it's not in the long term and intelligent way of caring for communities. So today I've given discourse about the seven Saptarishi Dhammas. So just to give you a recap on those, and if you have like a Buddhist dictionary, or you have you can look them up when you get home. And so there's the atta and dhamma, which is like the causes and the results, or the methods and the goals. And then knowing self, knowing the right amount or the optimum amount, knowing time and place, knowing individual, and knowing the community. So that would be the end of my talk this afternoon.